Hello and welcome to the New Zealand Initiatives podcast. I'm Oliver Hartwich and today I'm joined by my colleague Nick Clark. Hi Nick.
Hi Oliver.
We want to talk about our latest paper which we co-authored, and it's about the Belt and Road Initiative. It's a Chinese program to spend money and help countries around the world boost their infrastructure with the idea of actually bringing them into a new kind of Silk Road. And all roads in this scheme, of course, lead to China. And so we thought it would be a good idea to write up a paper about New Zealand's potential participation in this project. And that's the one that we just released today. And so let's just start from the very beginning. What is Belt and Road really?
Yeah, so the Belt and Road Initiative was launched by China in 2013, aiming, as you said, to increase trade between participating countries by improving infrastructure, lowering trade barriers, increasing cultural links and the like. That all sounds, you know, pretty benign stuff, but the BRI is also a central component of Xi Jinping's major country diplomacy strategy, which envisaged China taking a more assertive leadership role in global affairs.
And as such, it goes back to the year 2013. That's when it was launched. At the time, no one really had an idea what this would be, because at the time, Xi Jinping was quite new as president of China. But it actually marked quite a change in China's attitude to the world.
Yeah, so in years prior to that, I think there was a bit of a feeling that China felt it needed to sort of fly under the radar a little bit and let themselves develop without drawing too much attention to themselves. And they were trying to become accepted into the global economic and trade community, you know, joining the WTO, negotiating FTAs, including with New Zealand, one of the first ones, and basically, you know, trying to make itself more attractive to investment into China. And I guess the Belt and Road was a way to sort of start to push itself a little bit out a bit.
And that's right, because basically since China embarked on this big reform project under Deng Xiaoping, it was a project that basically looked at domestic policies in China. China was never an assertive power really in the last decades before Xi Jinping. And suddenly that changed, and Belt and Road signified that change, showing to the world that China took an interest in the world out there and started taking an active interest in developing projects in Africa, in South America, in Asia. And Belt and Road is perhaps the most visible expression of that.
Correct, correct. And there's around 150 countries that are participating in some way in the Belt and Road now. Most of those, as you say, Oliver, are in Africa and Asia. You know, not so many in Eastern Europe, not so many in Western or Northern Europe. Australia isn't part of it. You know, North America, the United States, Canada, Mexico aren't part of it. New Zealand is. We signed a memorandum of arrangement with China in 2017 that was sort of a non-binding agreement, which was more about looking at exploring opportunities. And yes, we signed that in 2017. It was thought that maybe there might be some potential for Belt and Road investment and infrastructure perhaps, but also other things like cooperation on trade facilitation, biosecurity, food safety, all those sorts of things that New Zealand does have quite a lot of expertise in as well.
And as you say, Nick, it's generally less developed countries signing up to Belt and Road, because for them, obviously, it promises better access to capital, whereas for the developed world, the Western world, the industrialized world, whatever you want to call it, Belt and Road wasn't that much of an issue. And in fact, I think the only really big country that ever signed up to Belt and Road from the Western sphere, Italy, announced just last year that they're pulling out of it.
That's correct. Yeah, they're a little bit of an oddity in that they did join the Belt and Road. They're the only G7 country that did join the Belt and Road. And yes, it withdrew its membership, I think, October, November last year.
And that was one of the big policy issues for Giorgia Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister. There's another country, actually, that recently started a rethink on Belt and Road, and I think that's Argentina.
Yes, that's with the election of the anarcho-capitalist Milei.
Yeah, indeed.
And he withdrew Argentina from the BRICS indeed. As well.
So because Milei actually wants to reintegrate Argentina into the broader Western sphere, whereas his predecessors, of course, actually rather tried to sign up with the BRICS. So that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and of course then Belt and Road by association.
Yep.
But actually from the Western sphere, no country would be engaged in this much, and certainly not a member of the Five Eyes. And here we get into the foreign policy dimensions of it, because Belt and Road, as nice as it sounds, and it of course it promises hundreds of billions of dollars of potential investment, but actually it is not an investment scheme. It is actually a foreign policy scheme. And that's the gist of our paper, really, to encourage people to really think beyond the dollars, beyond actually what it might finance, but actually ask yourself, well, why would any country give you preferential access to its capital?
Yeah, so we, as you say, we're the only Five Eyes country that has an arrangement or an agreement with China on Belt and Road. Australia doesn't, Canada doesn't, the United States doesn't, Britain doesn't. So it's a little bit of an oddity, if you like. We haven't gone too far down that path. Basically, we signed up to that arrangement back in 2017. It was automatically rolled over in 2022, so there was no sort of renegotiation or re-agreement. But basically, there isn't much that's happened. No real major discussions at a governmental level. And that's partly, I guess, because of the pandemic getting in the way, China's own economic issues, but also maybe a bit of hesitancy from New Zealand to, you know, engage too deeply in it for the reasons you've just mentioned.
Now, we should probably say, of course, on a more general level, we would be extremely happy to see New Zealand accept capital from around the world for infrastructure projects happening here. But Belt and Road's different.
Yeah, so, you know, we have a massive infrastructure deficit in New Zealand. It's been, you know, estimated to be in some quarters by at least $100 billion. We're not going to be able to get all that money from within New Zealand at all. So, you know, some of it, you know, a fair bit of it's going to have to come from overseas in one form or another, whether it's from loans or through direct investment. And yeah, the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, could potentially be a source of funding, but there's plenty of other you know, capital markets you can tap into as well. And I guess, you know, a lot of the enthusiasm initially around Belt and Road was around that infrastructure side of things. But as you say, it is very much a tool of China's foreign policy. You know, as you say, most Western countries have decided not to be part of it for those sorts of reasons. They don't want to be sort of locked in to, you know, strings attached, if you like, through investment leading to, you know, a pressure, whether it's overt or covert, of having to, you know, adopt or sort of be adhering to a particular foreign policy doctrine. And a lot of Western countries have decided not to do that.
Well, let's play devil's advocate then and say, well, actually, we mentioned in the paper countries like Laos, like Sri Lanka, and they've had their problems with Belt and Road lending, especially the case of Sri Lanka is well known. They went into bankruptcy, basically, as a country because they were just too indebted. And actually, Belt and Road was a part of that problem. Now, people might say, well, but look at New Zealand. I mean, New Zealand actually starts from a very different development point, and therefore, what happened in Sri Lanka probably wouldn't happen here. So there's not much to worry about from a New Zealand perspective about Belt and Road and falling into a debt trap. But I think that they would still overlook the basic fundamental problems here, is that right?
Yeah, so, I mean, people say, might say, well, what's China's actions in relation to those countries any different from any other investor that might be, you know, investing in a project and it goes belly up and the investor wants to get its money back? You know, China's been pretty aggressive in dealing with projects, countries that haven't met returns or have failed. And I guess that it comes down to motivation. So private investor, they want to get a good return on that investment financially. They want to meet their cost of capital or exceed it. And they therefore have a vested interest of making sure the project succeeds. I think with any state-backed investment, there financial returns may be part of it, but there's also going to be other non-financial motivations behind that investment, whether that's, you know, toeing the line in terms of what the foreign policy aspects are or funneling economic benefits from, say, China to those countries. So there is, it's not quite as simple as saying, well, they're no different from any other investor. They have their own motivations, and certainly with BRI, it's geopolitical.
So let's take it back to first principles then. A Belt and Road project is different from other investment projects because, well, if it wasn't, then these countries wouldn't gain anything from signing up to Belt and Road. They could just go to the market and get the same funding at the same conditions that they would get from Belt and Road. But that's not how it works. So Belt and Road gives you something above and beyond what countries could expect in normal capital markets. So you would probably get more favorable conditions, probably a better interest rate, something like that. But actually, that demonstrates that this is not a normal lending term. This demonstrates that you are not really the customer, you are the product.
Yes. Yep, that's one way of looking at it, for sure.
So the product actually means that China would gain something over you. It would probably have more influence on your domestic policy decisions. It would, at some stage, probably draw you into its sphere of influence, whereas, I mean, for a normal private investor, there is no sphere of influence that wouldn't be of their concern. They just want to make money, whereas China actually wants to make sure that you actually have something beyond that to offer.
Correct. Yep, that's the way I'd look at it as well. See what the paper does.
And therefore, for a country that actually considers itself independent, notoriously independent with our foreign policy, you wouldn't want to end up in that kind of sphere of influence.
No. And there's certainly a difference between having good trading relationships with a country like China. And certainly that's really important and useful. But when it comes to that sort of strings attached approach, we definitely want to steer clear of that. You know, and just observing that, you know, most of the countries that don't have involved in the Belt and Road, you know, China's a major market for them.
Absolutely.
Germany, for example.
Yeah, indeed. There's nothing wrong with trading. And I mean, that's a wonderful thing about trade. You don't have to like the people you trade with.
Yes.
Whereas when it comes to actually accepting a lot of money and taking directions, that is different.
Yep, definitely.
So where does Belt and Road then stand for New Zealand? I mean, we had a few utterances during last year's election campaign about Belt and Road and potentially seeing this as a chance to get some of the infrastructure gap financed. I remember actually seeing our former Prime Minister John Key on Breakfast TV talking about it, and you could see almost the dollar signs in his eyes. I mean, this is a very attractive proposition, he said. There are really billions and maybe trillions of dollars involved, and he could see the benefit. But did it move anywhere from there? Is there anyone currently in our political spectrum who would see this as an attractive proposition for New Zealand?
Well, certainly it's gone quiet since the election. So, you know, the now Prime Minister did talk about it prior to the election as an option. I mean, National Party's election platform for infrastructure for the last election talked about the need for overseas investment to help plug the infrastructure deficit. And, you know, the BRI was touted at the time as being something that could be looked into. I guess something that there's a lot of people, you know, seeing this Belt and Road and thinking there's billions of dollars sloshing around waiting to be shoveled out the door. But, you know, what's happened with China's economic situation, it's slowed down with its, you know, some of the projects, big projects that have failed and were not quite delivered what they expected. They've decided to sort of refocus the BRI on what I think Xi Jinping calls small but beautiful projects, particularly around things like IT and tech, as opposed to big, hard physical transport infrastructure like roads, rail, ports, airports, etc. So I think the potential upside of having lots and lots of cheap money coming in from China is not there as much as perhaps it might have been thought a few years ago.
Indeed, and it would look a bit strange actually reconsidering Belt and Road now when our foreign minister, Winston Peters, keeps talking about kind of reorienting New Zealand towards its traditional allies, talking openly about joining at least the second tier of AUKUS. Belt and Road wouldn't really fit into this kind of new foreign policy conception that Winston Peters talks about.
Not easily, no.
So, for the time being, Belt and Road, at least as New Zealand is concerned, is a no-go area.
Yeah, I mean, whether we physically take the approach the Italians took of withdrawing from it is one thing, but probably more likely it might just ebb away in the background.
I mean, there's not too much to withdraw from apart from the memorandum.
Yeah.
And that was really a really non-committal first step.
Yes.
It's hardly worth withdrawing from something that doesn't commit you to anything, but
yeah.
you don't see any appetite for any of our parties progressing further down that path.
I'm not aware of any, no. And I think all it would probably do is just perhaps cause a bit of unnecessary aggravation.
And in a way, that aligns with the message of the paper, because we say, well, actually, there is no good reason for us to go down that path anyway.
Yeah, yeah, and we're saying that we need a really cautious, careful approach to BRI engagement, to rush headlong into commitments that we might come to regret in the future, and, you know, just play it nice and steady and safe.
In which case, let's do that. Thank you, Nick.
Great, thanks, Oliver.